Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Eric Ries, entrepreneur and author of The Lean Startup, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired and author of the new book, Makers, The New Industrial Revolution. Chris Anderson is one of the premier writers and speakers on the effect new technology has on business. He has served as editor-in-chief of Wired since 2001. Under his leadership, the magazine has garnered numerous national magazine awards and has won the prestigious top prize for general excellence 3 times. His first book, The Long Tail, published in 2006, is the definitive account of how the internet has made it possible for smaller niche products to outsell their blockbuster counterparts. This was followed by his book, Free, in 2009, in which he explained how the new online marketplace of free products can actually make companies money. But I'm convinced he's going to be remembered for his newest book, Makers, The New Industrial Revolution, which explores how 3D printing, open source design, and other new tools are creating a new culture of creativity and entrepreneurship. It is really my honor and pleasure to welcome Chris Anderson.
Thank you, Eric, and it is very much my honor to be here on stage with you, thank you to the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity. This book came about by accident. I didn't set out to write it. I didn't set out to become part of the maker movement. It sort of washed over me as an exercise of parenting gone horribly wrong. I have 5 children, and I'm constantly trying to get them interested in science and technology. And so I always think of, you know, projects we can do together. I started a site called Geek Dad, which is all about sort of projects that are fun for you and fun for the kids, as opposed to fun for them and not fun for you, and the opposite as well. And yet I fail constantly in getting them interested, perhaps because I'm trying so hard. One Friday at the office, we got 2 boxes that came in, and the first was a Lego Mindstorms robotics kit, which was kind of really cool. Lego Mindstorms is basically Lego with sensors and actuators, and you can build Lego robots. It's really good. And the other box was a remote control airplane. And I thought, Saturday we'll build a robot, Sunday we'll fly a plane in the park. This will be the best Geek Dad weekend ever. So you can sort of see where this is going. Saturday we dutifully put together the robot. It's a little 3-wheeled tribot, and you put the pieces together, then you program. It's beautifully designed, great sort of drag and drop in programming language. I thought, this is awesome. The kids are going to love it. And we finally get it ready, and we push the button, and it kind of goes forward until it hits a wall, detects the wall, and then backs up. And the kids are like, you're kidding. I've seen Transformers. That's not a robot. Where are the lasers? It's not 3 stories tall. You know, it's not dealing death from the skies. And I'm like, okay. Hollywood has ruined robotics for children. It's hard to compete with CG. I get this. We always have tomorrow. So we're going to go to the park tomorrow. We're going to fly a plane and go to the park. And we watch YouTubes of acrobatics. And it was really cool. Go to the park, straight into a tree. And if that wasn't bad enough, it was the part where I climbed up the tree to retrieve it, which is completely mortifying. And much ice cream had to be bought to buy them off for that disaster. But I was thinking about it, and I was so frustrated. I'd failed once again at being a Geek Dad. I'd failed, once again at getting him excited about science and technology. And I was thinking, how could that have gone better? And I thought, I bet the Lego could have flown that plane better than me. It had these sensors. It had these, like, gyros and accelerometers and compasses and GPS and, Bluetooth. It would connect to GPS. And I was thinking, your phone in your pocket has all that stuff. I mean, I'll bet you could actually sort of fly a plane with this. And so I got the kids together, and we built a Lego autopilot and put in the plane that kind of almost worked. And it's now in the Lego Museum, I'm proud to say, the world's first Lego unmanned aerial vehicle. According, by the way, it turns out that the autopilots are regulated as munitions by the State Department, and technically we weaponized Lego that day. But what that made me realize is that there's something very exciting going on in what used to be hard to do stuff, electronics, sensors, things like that. And my little discovery with Lego Mindstorms and my children got me into the recognition that maybe hardware, maybe physical stuff, was something that I actually could do, and it was actually interesting, and it wasn't scary anymore. So I started messing around and learning a little bit, and I found something called Arduino, which is an open source computing board, and then learned more about sensors, and I kind of went way down the rabbit hole, and today I run a drone company with a Mexican drone factory. I'll just say that again, Mexican drone factory. And 5 years ago, I was just a dad messing around in the park with my kid and crashing into trees. And now we put more drones in the air than the U.S. military. Actually, we put more drones in the air every year than the entire U.S. military fleet. Not that ours are death-dealing, predator types. Ours are little sort of foam and sort of plasticky things that cost a few $100s. But the point is, we could do it. And that experience, recognizing that a regular guy just trying to be a kind of a geek dad ends up competing with the aerospace industry using open source hardware and open source software and readily accessible, technology, made me realize that something had happened. And I felt that chill. And the last time I felt that chill was when I first saw the first web browser. And when I realized that the concept of publishing was now a button, and the concept of putting things on the internet was now super easy. And we all remember that first moment when suddenly we realized that something that looked hard, broadcast, publishing, communicating to billions of people, had become a simple matter of opening a click, point and click, and pressing the publish button. That moment, that democratization of technology moment, was what had just happened with physical things. And then we got a 3D printer, which we didn't bring out one actually, but many of you may be familiar with 3D printers. They're basically just like a 2D printer, which is, a 2D printer takes pixels on your screen and turns them into dots of ink on paper, turns bits into atoms. It's a little bit of a, kind of an intellectualized framework, but that's really what it does. It turns digital stuff into physical stuff. And it does it and puts it on paper, then you hold it in your hand. And all a 3D printer does is it does the same thing, but just puts on more layers. Just adds really one motor to your little desktop printer, and it builds up things out of plastic or metals or things like that. Now, the ones you can get at home tend to do plastics, and we got one. And my children now grow up with a 3D printer, and they think it's completely normal that anything they can imagine, they can make. And anything they can draw on the screen, we can print out. And they complain about the resolution and the fact that we don't have enough colors and it's a little slow. But the point is that children have 3D printers now. Not all children, but this day shall come. And that, too, was a democratization moment. So that, once you've seen this, once you recognize that the technology that used to be hard and industrial and expensive is now cheap and easy, and we've introduced words like desktop and personal to formal industrial technologies, then you're like, wait, I remember this. I remember what happens when you add words like desktop and personal to technology. It's 1977, Homebrew Computing Club, and this is Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, and they just realized that this little chip that you can buy in a store can actually make a computer, which could become a personal computer and a desktop computer, and they change the world. And I realize we're doing this, we have the opportunity right now to do the same thing, not with computers, but with manufacturing. And the nice thing about, and the amazing thing about doing it with manufacturing is that, now we're talking. Now we're talking about moving the needle for the economy as a whole. Industrial, we are a world that's primarily atoms. The industrial economy is larger than the digital economy. If we could take the innovation model of the web, if we could take the social forces, the cultural revolution of the web and apply this to the biggest industries in the world, the internet could be just the beginning, and we could really see what the digital revolution can do. When you think about it this way, the subtitle of my book is The New Industrial Revolution, and there's really, I'm gonna sort of phrase this as the third industrial revolution. And let me just explain how this works. The first industrial revolution, which all of you know, is actually here's a quiz. How many people think that the first industrial revolution came in the 1700s? Nobody. How many think it came in the 1800s? About half the room. And how many people think it came in the 1900s? A smaller group. Okay, so most of you think it happened in the 1800s. First, the answer is that nobody has a precise definition, but most people start actually in 1776, around the same time as the American Revolution, with the spinning jenny. The spinning jenny, now we'd had spinning wheels all the way back to, you know, fairy tale times, but a spinning jenny was just multiple wheels, and it often had a treadmill, foot power, to drive multiple wheels that could spin multiple threads at the same time. Now, what that meant is we basically had amplified human potential, that one person could spin multiple threads. And that amplification of human potential meant that people became more productive, and you could start to not just make clothes for yourself and your friends, but start to be a little bit of an entrepreneur, a cottage industry, if you will. And then that foot power turned into water power, and there was probably horsepower in there as well, and then ultimately steam power and electric power and beyond. But that basically replaced muscle power with machine power and amplified human capacity. It doubled lifespan in the United Kingdom in over 100 years. It took the population from, you know, sort of like 3 to 5 million to 30 to 50 million. It hugely improved quality of life as people moved from the rural, the countryside, to the cities. You may think that the factories were dark satanic mills and they probably weren't nice places, but by moving people from the country to the city, you had things like access to clean water, sanitation. You had access to education. The walls were dry. I mean, those little rural villages were great, but the walls were wet and damp, and people didn't live very long. And ultimately, this hugely improved quality of life and created the modern world. But that one came at a cost, and the cost was we moved to the factories. That, you know, fundamentally, it was all about mass production. The man who owned the factory. It was about basically doing what worked at a factory scale. All good stuff. We're here because of this, but there was a cost, which is mass production. The cottage industry, the artisanal, the distributed, all become centralized and industrial. That was the first industrial revolution. That took us through the spinning jenny all the way through to the steam engine, the Ford, Henry Ford's production line, and all this kind of stuff. First industrial revolution. Second industrial revolution, I would argue, is the digital revolution. I didn't say the computer revolution because I don't think it started with the computer itself. The first computers were owned by the military and by big, you know, companies and countries and universities. But that's not, I think, what was the revolution. The revolution was that 1977 one I described before, where Jobs and Wozniak introduced the word personal and desktop to computing. It wasn't the invention of the computer, it was the democratization of the computer. It was putting computing technology in the hands of everybody so that our ideas, our creativity, our energy, our needs ultimately figured out what the computer was for. So that was the digital revolution. The maker revolution, and I'll define in a moment what the maker movement I think is, the maker revolution is really just the combination of the two. It's digital meets industrial. It is the digitization of the manufacturing technology, but not just introducing digital technology into factories, because we've had that for decades. You know, big companies have had that for, since the 1970s. What it is that just as in personal computer, it's the democratization of that. It is the introduction of digital manufacturing tools to anybody and everybody. And that is when we start to see the web's innovation model, when we start to see the creativity, the energy of everybody start to come to bear on some of the biggest industries in the world. This is the maker movement. And everyone, you know, there are many definitions of the maker movement. I just wanted to kind of give you a little taxonomy about it. I think the credit for the term goes to Dale Doherty, who works for O'Reilly, one of the co-founders of O'Reilly, a big publishing company. And around 2005, 2006, he recognized there was something going on in DIY. It was that he saw the web generation starting to use their hands more. He saw them starting to work together in communities and share ideas a little bit more. He saw digital tools start to affect what they were doing. And he created Make Magazine, which is kind of the Bible of the movement. Maker fairs, which are hugely successful. There's one in San Mateo each year that does more than 100,000 people come to over the weekend. There's one in New York a couple weekends ago. And so I think the maker movement was something that they identified first. O'Reilly is a leading edge tech publisher, so it's not coincidental that they spotted that this was technologically driven, but they're also in Sebastopol and the sort of, you know, kind of maybe their roots, and I hope Tim O'Reilly will forgive me, their roots are a little bit in the 60s kind of, you know, social change, power to the people. You know, Sebastopol is not San Francisco. It's, you know, they have their roots in the country. And I think they recognize that there was, just as Jobs and Wozniak did, a cultural revolution under this as well. So it was a combination of digital technologies and new tools allowing people to do extraordinary things, and then the recognition that people want to use their hands, that we're all makers on some sense. If you're a cook, you're a maker. If you're a gardener, you're a maker. Kids are born makers. You know, there's a certain dignity and a satisfaction in holding something you've made in your hands, but we didn't have the skills to do this stuff, or most of us didn't have the skills. And what they recognized is that these digital technologies were good with screens, were bad with, you know, metal lathes, and what they realized is that these digital technologies were going to allow us to capture our ideas and make them real without having to get a degree in machining. That's the maker movement. It's the web generation meets the real world. It is a new generation of technologies allow us, much as the personal computer and the web did, to start to compete with the biggest companies in the world and create a new kind of manufacturing industry that's grassroots, that's democratized, that's bottoms up, and that, just like the web, can compete with the biggest industrial giants in the world with a new kind of innovation model. So that's the maker movement. I think I'll probably, you know, finish now that we've defined terms and finish and talk a little bit about what it means for our country and for the economy, because if you call it an industrial revolution, you know, it better move the needle.
Yeah.
So let me stop there, and we'll turn to the conversation.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate you doing this, and I think it's very interesting that you've drawn these parallels between what's happening in this, you know, physical industrial revolution and the kind of previous antecedents, the semiconductor revolution, the digital revolution, as you talked about. One thing I remember, you know, just from watching the growth of the web, and I've read in history in many of these revolutions, and is reflected already in the questions that are coming right up, is that people are a little bit skeptical that what is happening in hobbyist garages is relevant to, you know, the mass manufacturing, and as you said, what's going to move the needle. And I thought I'd just share one of these questions with you.
Sure.
As we start, this is from the audience. While I completely understand the applicability of Moore's Law to 3D printing, I think you have way, way, way overstated what is or will ever be possible with 3D printing. I understand your logic, but those who have not 3D printed will be disappointed. Please comment.
All right. Good question. So first of all, this is not just about 3D printers. 3D printers are just one of several, a whole generation of digital fabrication tools. There's laser cutters and CNC machines and CNC embroidery and CNC quilters. And, you know, if you buy a sewing machine, a fancy sewing machine these days from Sears, it's basically a digital fabrication tool as well. So 3D printers are the ones we all gravitate towards for a couple reasons. First of all, that companies like MakerBot have made them very, very, very accessible. And second of all, it's kind of mind-blowing. It's just kind of one of those things where like, whoa, you know, Replicator, Star Trek, this would be awesome. Tea, Earl Grey, hot, you know, the deal. So let me explain a little bit more.
When's that coming?
Yeah, exactly. Let me explain a little bit more about how 3D printing works. And let me explain also that 3D printing is not a mass production technology. It's a rapid prototyping technology. It's a great way to make one of something. Which is good for two things. Either to make the prototype that you're ultimately going to make many of, or because you want something that's custom, just for you. You don't want the mass-produced thing. Today, industrial 3D printers and you know, my robot company, we have industrial 3D printers, and they're fantastic. At home, we have a MakerBot, and it's pretty crude. It's more like a dot matrix printer. Right now, the ones you buy at home basically take a filament of plastic, ABS plastic, which is the same stuff that you use in Lego, and just kind of melt it, and, you know, it sort of squeeze it out in a little bead, and it builds things up over layers. There's other ways that use resins, you know, liquid resin. There's things that use powders, etc. You can go to a site called Shapeways, and they have like more expensive 3D printers, and you can upload that same design, and you can get things printed in titanium, stainless steel. You know, gold-plated, et cetera. The quality is astounding. GE, you know, 3D prints turbine blades for jet engines. So there's almost, you know, there are some limits to what you can do with a 3D printer, but not that many. What the limit is that those titanium printing ones are quite expensive. The question is simply, how long is it going to take? You know, so it took, I don't know, what, 15 years to get from the dot matrix printer to the photo quality inkjet on your desktop.
Mm-hmm.
About 15 years, maybe a little bit longer.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we're at the dot matrix phase on the desktop right now. How long is it going to take to the photo quality printer? I don't think it's going to be 15 years, in part because it actually shares the same sort of mechanical technology as that inkjet.
Mm-hmm.
It just adds, rather than inkjet is to be a little wonky, an XY printer, and just this 3D printer is an XYZ. The interesting stuff gets into like materials. So right now on my printer we can do one color in plastic, then at pretty low resolution. The next one we'll do one color in plastic. We'll do two colors in plastic at better resolution. The next one we'll do three colors and start to mix them. And now you're starting to to be able to kind of print images as well as shapes. The one after that will use more than just plastic, or allows me to mix materials. Maybe I'll be able to put the electrical wiring in, along with the plastic. Maybe I'll be able to use some. So now I can use other substances like PLA, which is a starch-based substance. It's biodegradable. I had the privilege of talking to Craig Venter, the biologist in New York last week at our World Health Conference. He's developing a DNA printer.
Now you're really starting to freak people out.
Yeah. So we know how to sequence genes super easily. At least if you're a scientist, these machine sequencers are not hard. Mm-hmm. I think you can buy them on eBay now. But DNA synthesis, in other words, printing out, so we know how to copy, we know how to, to read the DNA and then to print the DNA. That's called DNA synthesis. It's a big industrial tool, but he's intending to make it a desktop-sized one so that, like, for example, every year, so we all get our flu shots, right? The flu shot at the beginning of the season, probably recently got them, or you will soon. That's a guess at what the flu is going to be this year. We never know. It depends. It's on how it propagates from Asia. What if, rather than guessing at the beginning of the season, you just, the doctor sent you an email saying, actually, it turns out the flu is not A, B, C, D, but, XYZ. Here's a little code that allows you to print out your own vaccine. And, or they could get a little liquid and drink it, give it to the kids with the Cheerios, and, pow. So that's a 3D printer as well. That's printing DNA, which is a physical material. Now, obviously, at this point you have to ask things like, what could possibly go wrong?
We have a few questions to that effect. Yeah.
Ideas like, you start to get, metaphors like killer app start to get a little too literal. I think the only thing that stands in our way, so basically I'm very bullish on 3D printers. I've seen a lot of the latest technology and I'm very impressed. I agree that you're not going to print an iPhone anytime soon. But you can print metals and mm-hmm. electronics of various sorts. Maybe not semiconductors, but at least the printed circuit boards, et cetera. So I think I'm pretty bullish on this. I think it's going to happen faster than it did with regular printers. And the only caveat I would make is that it's not a mass production technology. It's a prototyping technology. Well, so if you want to make a million of something, up it goes, and you injection mold it rather than.
A lot of people want to talk about the disaster scenarios and the things that can go wrong. And we're talking about drones and synthetic biology. I'm certainly getting nervous. But before we get into that, I think we want to talk about what are the impacts on the economy. We want to talk about the macroeconomic impacts. We're in a political season. People are talking about job creators and bringing manufacturing back. And I thought maybe before we get to the macro, it'd be good to talk about just the micro effects that you're talking about the difference between mass production and this kind of prototyping technology. You had a great graph in the book that made me laugh called Two Ways to Make a Duck.
Yeah.
I thought maybe we could start there.
All right. So when you get a 3D printer and you have an idea and you print it out, it's incredibly exciting. You hold it in your hand and then you maybe, post it on YouTube or you... you tweet about it, and then you think, this is great, and maybe people say, that's awesome. I'd like one, too. And then you say, you print a second one, and then you print a third one, and then you realize that you're going to spend your whole life watching the printer work. So you're going to have to learn a new set of technologies, and these are mass production technologies. The good news is that I actually went back to 1977 in the Apple II, but I probably would have been like even more appropriate to go to 1984 with the Macintosh,
mm-hmm.
and 1985 with the first laser printer from Apple as well. And we forget how mind-blowing that was, or at least I sometimes do. This introduced the concept of desktop publishing, and desktop publishing is like whatever. It doesn't sound exciting, but that was kind of amazing publishing. Publishing used to be something you needed a factory for. It's called a printing plant. You know, never argue with someone who buys ink by the barrel. You know, rolls of paper on railway cars. Publishing was hard. And now you could put it on your, you could do it on your desktop. That this software, you could just point and click, and out would come sort of high-quality professional stuff. And that was super exciting, but you could only make a few of them because, you know, it takes a long time to get the printer. But those printers spoke a language called PostScript. And that language was the same language spoken by the biggest printers in the world. So you could prototype on your desktop, then upload it to a printer, printing plant, and you really could publish. And that was kind of exciting. And then we did the same thing with the web. And you could, you know, sure, you could write code on your desktop, but then along came the web, and now you could push code out to the whole world, and now you could broadcast, and you could distribute as well, and that was super exciting. And now we're doing the same thing with physical goods. That rather than PostScript, all these, what we now have is new languages called, you know, not, we have digital languages for physical things called G-code and STL and others. And the same you know, language that drives that MakerBot on your desk will drive the biggest factories in the world. You just upload your file, and rather than 3D printing it, they'll do the inverse. They'll this gets again a little wonky, but what they'll do is a 3D print is an additive technology. It builds up something, but you can just take the opposite, and you can cut away that object. And when you cut away that object, now you've made a mold. And now you've made a mold, now you can injection mold things, and you can make millions of them for like pennies. And so, in other words, to go from one to many, it's simply a matter of using the same file and just outputting it in a different technology, in a different place. And we have concepts like cloud manufacturing. You can upload, you can go to sites like Alibaba, and you can just sort of, you don't have to be a company, you don't have to be anybody, you just upload your file, they'll take a credit card, and they'll mass produce stuff for you. You know, robots in China will work for you, and they take PayPal.
It's pretty exciting. I mean, in the software world, when we got to this continuous path to scale, where you could test and iterate on the prototype very quickly and get feedback and take that exact same product, you know, from your dorm room in Harvard all the way up to, you know, the public company, with the same basic technology stack, same underlying languages, it unleashed a whole new wave of entrepreneurship. So I join you in being very excited. But we got a lot of skeptics who have been sending their questions. And a big concern is, here's a question that's just, how is this going to affect the future of American manufacturing? A lot of people worry that because, you know, in the democratized world of the internet, network effects businesses are dominant. Does this mean that actually this is going to result in fewer firms, less choice for people in the products that they have? And if this is going to destroy, you know, so people are simultaneously pessimistic, but then some people are so optimistic that if this is going to destroy traditional manufacturing, what are people going to do?
Well, I wrote a book called Long Tail, which was about what happened when the barriers to entry to publishing and content creation fell to zero, which is what the web did. And the answer is it created an explosion of choice, a huge amount of variety. A lot of people became producers who couldn't have become producers before. But the biggest misunderstanding is that it was going to be the end of the blockbuster. And it wasn't. It was the end of the monopoly of the blockbuster. Hollywood still exists even though we have YouTube. Mm-hmm. Right? And recognizing that there's a when you involve more people into creation, they tend to grow the pie. They tend to find new niches and, you know, new ways to create stuff. They tend to, you know, their creativity tends to expand our potential as both a culture and an economy. And, you know, mainstream media still exists, even though the web has provided infinite competition. I think the same thing will tend to happen with manufacturing. You know, I went from, you know, playing with Lego with my kids. In 5 years, we now have two factories, you know, one in Tijuana and one in San Diego. We have about 40 employees. We run very sophisticated pick-and-place machines, which are electronics manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could say we compete with aerospace. We compete with the Boeings and the Lockheeds and Martins of the world, but we don't because we're addressing an entirely different market. We're looking at sort of, you know, personal drones, and they're looking at military drones.
Can you explain what personal drones are? We got quite a few questions that people can't understand what business you have running a drone company.
My wife is among them. So a drone is just a robot, a flying robot. They fly themselves, you don't fly them. They have autopilots and GPS, and they have cameras and things like that. And you know, here's something you probably you may be able to relate to. So out in the bay, maybe not right now since it's dark, but out in the bay there's windsurfers, and it's the GoPro generation, so we all want cool videos of us doing our extreme sports. The problem is when you're windsurfing, it's really hard to get a good video of that. What you really want is a camera about 30 feet behind you and 30 feet up. It's focused on you the whole time. Now, you can hire a helicopter to, you know, do this, but, you know, it's pretty expensive, and you better not, you know, you better get on that board or else you're going to be embarrassed. Or you could just have a robot camera follow you around. And that's what a personal drone is. That's what ours and others will do, is you just sort of have a little box in your pocket, so called a follow me box, and you just push the button, and your what's called a quadcopter, or, you know, basically a multi-bladed helicopter that's been sitting on the shore, you know, takes off, comes over you, positions itself 30 feet behind, 30 feet above you, keeps the camera focused on you, and just follows you around as you do your cool stuff. And then when the battery gets low, it just flies itself back to the shore. You know, Star Wars droid, you know, personal droid. We can have a personal droid. I mean, there are people out there in the bay doing it now.
Probably not right now.
Not right now. It is dark. It is dark. But wait till the weekend. So this is possible. I know this sounds very scary. Skynet's become self-aware, etc. But you know, but remember, the internet was a military technology. Computers were a military technology, mm-hmm. and now we understand the personal application. I think we're right there. With drones as well. So I'm sorry, I've actually forgotten what the question was.
That was it. People wanted to know, what is a personal drone? What does it do? Going back to the kind of consequences of this, you've also wrote in the book about how this is going to require a whole new financing method for developing these companies, for funding them, not in the traditional way of top-down. A lot of questions about, are VCs going to understand this? Are bankers going to understand this? Are private equity... Probably not, certainly not at this stage. And we've also seen the emergence of companies like Kickstarter and Etsy that are finding new ways, kind of almost accidental ways, to bring financing into the maker economy.
Yeah.
So what's it going to look like from a financing point of view?
So, you know, while I was writing the book, the biggest... So I knew about digital fabrication. I knew about the web's innovation model. I could see, you know, the maker movement underway. But I didn't actually have an answer to the funding thing. I was kind of like, bootstrap it, credit cards. You know, that's how we did it. But it's, you know... It's not always the best answer. And then along came, you know, Kickstarter. Let me take a quick poll. How many people here have backed a Kickstarter project? Wow. Okay, so I would say at least half the room has backed a Kickstarter project. That's fantastic, and that is telling as well. So when you backed a Kickstarter project, you were the venture capitalist for the maker movement, and you probably knew that. Just for those who aren't familiar with Kickstarter, it's what's called a crowdfunding site. It's basically a way to pre-order products that both sort of, you know, funds the team to make it and sort of tests whether this product deserves to exist in the first place. It does three wonderful things. The first is that it moves money forward in time. When you think about like traditional product development, it's kind of all wrong. So what you would need to do is all of your costs are at the front end. You've got to prototype the product. You've got to do your R&D. You've got to, you know, tool up. You've got to get, you know, component inventories. You do the manufacturing. You know, all this money sunk into this stuff. You've got to warehouse it, put them in the distribution channel. Only after you've done all that stuff and people start buying it does the money come back to you. And that's why you have to raise money from venture capitalists to take bank loans or mortgage your house, et cetera, because you need money now and you're not going to get paid until later. Well, all Kickstarter does is it just says, well, you know, pre-order it, and we'll get the money now when we need it, and then we don't have to go VC, bank, mortgage, the house thing. That's the first thing. Moves money forward in time to when you need it. Second thing, it does market research. The way Kickstarter works is there's a target. Say there was a famous Pebble smartwatch that had a target of $100,000. If they didn't raise $100,000 in pre-orders, it was never going to be made. If you fail your target, that's a gift. That just tells you, this product was probably not going to be as successful, and you've saved yourself a huge amount of time and money. So market research is wonderful, and I know this is something you talk a lot about in Lean Startup, but the ability to lower the risk, it is almost the minimum you know, viable unit, you know, passing that threshold of Kickstarter confirms that you've got the minimum viable unit. And the third thing it does is it builds communities. All those people who've pre-ordered a product aren't just customers. They're part of a movement. They are part of your team. They are evangelizing. The very act of backing it, they start tweeting this, and they are, you know, word of mouth starts kicking in, and then there are comments, and they have, like, now that they've backed a product, they feel like they have a right to tell you how to make that product, and you have an obligation to listen to them. And like the Kickstarter smartwatch was a perfect example. People were like, I love it. I wish it were more waterproof. And the team's like, the four guys in Palo Alto, the team's
waterproof?
Like, waterproof? We can do that. And they're like, Bluetooth 3? I think Bluetooth 4 would be cooler, better battery life. And they're like, all right, we'll source that. I'd like more colors. And, you know, thousands and thousands of comments, and the team listened and responded, and now all those people who participated in the, and when I say participated in the project, they just, essentially, it's pre-ordered a product, but because of the way Kickstarter is structured,
they're part of it.
They're part of it. And then when it comes out, they will become evangelists, and this is the kind of marketing money can't buy. Mm-hmm. So that is the answer. I think that, you know, that is one answer to the funding model. There's still venture capital, still a good option. You know, friends and family, credit cards is, you know, again, it's getting cheaper and cheaper to do this. Credit cards is not a bad way to bootstrap an operation. But the great thing is that these things, business model for maker movement companies is not hard. It's like sell things for more than they cost, period. Now, I realize I'm probably for you. Sell things for more than they cost. This is like, you know, a 17th century English, you know, Apple sales cart would know this, and yet, so we've been laboring in the internet business where the products have no intrinsic cost of manufacturing. We've been laboring on how we're going to come up with business models. I wrote a book on that free. With physical stuff, it's just super easy. You just, you know, you add a margin onto your production costs, and people still get it wrong. They don't charge enough, or they don't really understand what the production costs are. But basically, it's not like, you know, calculus. And the great thing about it is that if you just set it up right, you get paid on day one.
What's your favorite Kickstarter project that you've backed?
I do love the Pebble smartwatch. I'm a bit of a kind of a quantified self junkie, and you know, I'm full of like this Nike Fuel Band here, and you know, all sorts of, my phone's measuring us as we speak. And
how are we doing?
I'm a little old school. I do actually like looking at the time on my wrist.
I know.
Resolutely middle-aged, but the Pebble smartwatch I love not only because it's the kind of watch I want. It communicates right with my phone. Mm-hmm. It measures my activities, etc. But I love the fact that on the same week that the Pebble announced the smartwatch, Sony announced their smartwatch, right? And you may not have heard of Sony's smartwatch, but you probably have heard of the Pebble smartwatch. And the fact that four kids in Palo Alto could essentially outcompete one of the biggest consumer electronics companies in the world is a real sense of what the maker movement can do.
It's pretty cool. It's going to be a great experiment to watch.
Yeah.
We'll see who wins. I'm not betting on Sony.
No, and if it isn't going to be Pebble, it's going to be somebody like Pebble. And you know, when we talk about the Internet of Things, et cetera, it's all going to come out of the maker movements. You know, don't look to big consumer electronics companies for that level of innovation, that pace of engagement with the community.
And so, thinking about other consequences of that, we have a lot of questions about how is this, what are the organizational forms then that those companies are going to take? Are they going to have to borrow the kind of bureaucracy and coordination techniques of big companies in order to compete on a head-to-head basis? Is this going to be a new kind of company that's born? What are these organizations
like? I wish I could tell you that it's totally virtual and, you know, and loosey-goosey and open and transparent. No, it's like, yes, you may start that way, but the moment you get into like real production, mass manufacturing, suddenly you have huge respect for enterprise resource planning and roles and responsibilities and letters, you know, and letters of credit or lines of credit from the bank, and you learn, you basically get huge respect for traditional manufacturing very quickly, or you don't get there. So we started our drone company our drone community is open source. We're part of the Arduino movement. We're all out there, super transparent. But as we got bigger and everything got more complicated, we found out we were sort of just basically starting to look like GE. We have roles and responsibilities. There's team leaders. People get hired. They get fired. We have supply chain management. You know, we have accountants. We have lawyers. And we have for good reasons, which is that, you know, when you deal with this kind of scale, you basically have to, there's a reason why manufacturing, why America's still, you know, the leading manufacturer in the world, although not the leading creator of manufacturing jobs, and that's because, you know, we're pretty good at using technology to, in traditional industries like manufacturing and doing it well, and so we find ourselves not reinventing, you know, not sort of not coming up with this radical new concept of manufacturing, but more getting to where they already were faster, and not having to be a big company to do it.
Yeah, that change in what's required to get started, that just seems, we keep coming back and back to that we don't have to have a huge cost, you don't have to build a huge infrastructure.
Right.
Seems really fundamental.
And a lot of this is moving to the cloud, a lot of this is using open source software. Mm-hmm. And the one difference I would say is that the maker companies, although they end up, you know, using quite traditional manufacturing technologies and systems, the one thing that differentiates them is that they have community at the core of what they do. They work in public. Etsy is another great example of a big maker community. But the recognition that your customers are not just customers, but they're essentially part of your, they could potentially be part of your innovation model if you structure it right and bring them into the process early on. That, I think, is a very web-like lesson that the maker community has applied to traditional manufacturing.
Absolutely. I'd like to add that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program.
Our guest, Wired editor and author Chris Anderson, who is discussing a new vision for entrepreneurship that brings manufacturing to the desktop. I thought maybe we'd switch gears. One of the things I really liked about your book is that this is not just a business phenomenon for you, but there was kind of a personal aspect to it. Mm-hmm. You share your story, you know, of making things with your daughters and the legacy from your family. I thought maybe you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's after I kind of got into this and, you know, started fiddling around with electronics and got the 3D printer, I was like, you know, I'm going to need a I was doing it like in our study, and I was like, and I have a little tiny desk, and it was starting to pile really high, and my wife was getting kind of annoyed. So I thought, I'll need a workshop. You know, it's time.
You
know,
of course.
A man needs a workshop. So we built one, and I was like, oh, wait, this is all coming back to me. And I was like, oh, my God. I remember that when I was a kid, I spent my summers in Los Angeles with my grandfather. And this is 30 years earlier, and I sort of had forgotten about it. And it all flashed back to me. And I realized that it had been in my sort of blood all along, my grandfather. Fred Hauser was a Swiss immigrant in Los Angeles in the 1920s, and he worked in Hollywood when it was a mechanical business, you know, to film loops and tape loops and such. And, you know, it was all gears and motors, et cetera. But at home, he was an inventor. And he invented exactly what a Swiss engineer, who's kind of a little bit of a watchmaker, would invent in Los Angeles in the 1920s and 30s, which is to say, you know, Los Angeles was booming. They were greening the desert. They had all these lawns, these green lawns, and they had these sprinkler systems. And the sprinkler systems were very fancy and had all sorts of cool little sort of, you know, automated heads, etc. But you had to turn them on manually. And what he realizes that we need to do is you need to put a watch on top of the sprinkler system, a timer, so that it would be automatic. And so he invented the automatic sprinkler system. So if you have one, that's my grandfather's patent, long ago expired, but that's what he invented. And I would spend my summers with him, and he would teach me about invention and about mechanical drawing. And then as I got older, I was 12, and there's pictures of me in my jeans jacket and in the workshop. I would spend my summers in his little workshop learning how to use metal lathe and to do machining. And we would, one summer we got a box. He said, we're going to make a gas-powered engine this summer. And I've ordered a kit. And I'm like, okay, cool, I get it. You know, I've built model airplanes. You know, it's plastic, and it's got numbers and instructions, and you glue it together. And, like, we open up the box, and there's these four blocks of metal. And I'm like, where's the engine? He says, it's in there. We have to get it out. And this is blueprint. And we literally did it. He did it. But, you know, in the hands of a master, a machinist, you take a block of metal, and out of this comes a cylinder and a piston and a crankshaft, and it was just stunning. But then I forgot about it for 30 years. And the reason being is that I didn't have his skills. I wasn't a machinist. And it was he could take his idea and go from drafting board to prototype because he had the skills. And I didn't. And what I needed was all that complexity to be turned into a black box. And that black box was my 3D printer and then later my CNC mm-hmm. machine and the laser cutters, et cetera. Taking the hard sort of, you know, craftsman skills out of the process and allowing you to go from idea to prototype with the push of a button, that's what brought me back into it. And then I realized it had been in my blood all along, just uh-huh. waiting for the technology to be ready. My children, as they grow up with 3D printers, and here's what we do with my daughters. I have three daughters, and we're a little strict about video game time. They're allowed 2 hours per weekend day, and that's it. The girls are really into The Sims. Does anyone know the Sims, The Sims 3? Yeah, so it's like a dollhouse game, and you do virtual dollhouse, and you make these really cool sort of homes and furnishing and put people in it. And then when it's time for the video game time is over, we're like, okay, screen's off. You got to play in the real world. And by the way, you have a real dollhouse. Why don't you play with that? And they're like, it's not as cool. And, Dad, will you buy me some new dollhouse furniture? And I'm pretty good at saying no to these things, but I thought I had to do a little research first. And so I went on to Amazon to look at dollhouse furniture. And first of all, it's very expensive. Second of all, there's very little choice. And third of all, and this is the really troubling thing, it's all the wrong size. It turns out there's no standardization of dollhouse furniture scale. And, you know, and it turns out the figures are slightly different the scale than the rest of the house. And you have to say, they're not very, very nimble, so you actually need to get them a little smaller so that they sit properly in the couches. And we kept getting it wrong. And so I'm like, no, I'm not buying any more dollhouse furniture. It's just not working out. It's not as cool as The Sims 3. However, we do have a 3D printer. So we went online to a site called Thingiverse, which is a repository of open designs that people put out there. And we found that there are the most beautiful designs created by a designer named who goes by the name Pretty Small Things. By day, she designs sets for Broadway. She's a theatrical set designer in New York. And by night, she designs beautiful dollhouse furniture and gives away the designs for free on Thingiverse. And so we download them, and we scale them with a little slider. That's all you have to do is pull a little slider. We scale them to exactly the right size. We print them out, and then the girls paint them. And this, they can make any dollhouse furniture they want, anything they can imagine we can create. They paint them to make it personal and theirs, and they treasure this stuff the way they wouldn't treasure anything that was mass-produced and bought in Walmart. They put them on the shelves of their bedroom. You know, and my boys do Warhammer 40K, you know, mechs, as you might imagine, and, you know, probably violating some intellectual property in there somewhere. But they, too, can make it exactly the way they want it and paint it, and they treasure it in the way they wouldn't otherwise. So we now realize from my grandfather to my children, yeah. We've found a kind of a thread that runs through all of this, which is basically we're all makers, we're just waiting for the right tools.
So there seems like there's this real, like, back to the roots nostalgia woven through this. You know, I was thinking about the Whole Earth catalog, and, you know, the original managers were random machine shops, and there's this kind of, got a lot of questions about, you know, wood shop and other classes that have been removed from curricula. There's kind of this old making strain in American life, and now it's got this resurgence, but from robots. What do you make of that kind of like agrarian robot combination?
You know, I use the word robots for effect as well, but the reality is they're just machines. They're just basically, you know, computers that do stuff. I think that we have an opportunity to tap that instinct in all of us, mm-hmm. and just not only allow us to do more cool stuff, but allow us to share this and work and inspire others. I have two homework assignments for those of you in the audience. Number one, if you have children, consider that this might be the holiday season that you get that 3D printer. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, I'm guessing it's the age of many of us, remember when we were kids and our parents got a home computer? And, you know, a home computer, remember, it's a kind of archaic phrase, but a home computer probably cost about $2,000. It was a pretty significant investment mm-hmm. for the parents. It was for the home. It wasn't quite clear what it was for. I think programming kind of figured into it. The sense was that it was a 21st century skill, and they would bring it into the home, and the kids would figure out how to use it, and ultimately they would be better for it. I think we're right about there with a 3D printer. That cost the same thing, about $2,000. You would have a home 3D printer. Mm-hmm. It seems clear that it's a 21st century skill. We're not quite clear what the killer app was. We probably didn't know when we got those first home computers, but, you know, eventually it would emerge. But we do know that it'll inspire the kids to imagine what they can be. So I think the time is right. This holiday season is the one that you should consider, especially if you have kids. The second homework assignment is if you have a relationship with your local school, especially if you have kids, they have a relationship with the school, I think we have an opportunity right now to right a wrong. And the wrong was, and it's not a wrong, it's a perfectly reasonable choice, but shop class, home economics, industrial arts, you know, that was something in high school as we were kids when manufacturing jobs were considered a viable route to the middle class. And then they weren't anymore, and they got replaced by mm-hmm. computer class or budget cuts or liability insurance. You know, they just thought bandsaws were actually quite dangerous, and et cetera. But they got wiped out. And I think we have an opportunity to bring it back in, not by reinstating traditional shop class, by simply adding a couple 3D printers to the computer lab we've already got. You add mm-hmm. a 3D printer to a computer lab, and now you have a design lab. And to insert the word design into our educational curriculum, and not only design, but digital design, is an opportunity to really teach a 21st century skill. And when you think that a kid, you know, right now our computer labs are teaching kids how to use PowerPoint. Along with that, but if they could teach them how to use Tinkercad or some kind of CAD or even Minecraft, which they think is a game but is actually a CAD program, and they can design stuff and they can print it out and they can take it home, that's going to change a kid's life. That's going to make them. That's going to blow their mind and make them realize that maybe design is something they can do, and maybe it's a small D design, not a capital D design. Maybe it doesn't require an advanced degree. But the point is that we are going to create a generation of makers. That's when the 21st century skills turn into the curriculum, and that's how we create an industrial revolution, bring manufacturing back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm. It's really exciting. I mean, my parents had a home computer just exactly like you described, and that fact of that purchase absolutely changed my life. And if you look at the story of a lot of successful internet entrepreneurs and you work backwards to, well, what were they doing? Why, you know, why was Zuckerberg able to become an internet entrepreneur when he was in college? It's because since he was a kid, he was in his parents' basement, proverbial basement, programming on computers. That was true for Bill Gates. I mean, been true for a lot of entrepreneurs. And so to create that opportunity for a next generation to do that, not just in the, you know, in the realm of the internet, but in the industrial settings, is pretty
exciting. So if I'm right, 20 years from now, somebody will be sitting on this chair, having just taken their company public, and they'll say, what changed my life is my parents brought home the home...
That could be your kid.
Printer.
Home 3D printer. All right. Before anybody goes out and buys a 3D printer for their kids, we're going to have to deal with the Armageddon questions.
Oh, yes.
Which have been pouring in, because, I mean, my first question is, are you at all nervous about this? I mean, we've been talking about the positive effects, and I'm very excited about it, but I just read a book called Kill Decision.
Yeah.
About autonomous killer drones that, you know, are cheap to manufacture, can be done anywhere by hobbyists, and start destroying. I won't ruin it for anybody, but pretty nasty, nasty stuff. And they have their own ability to make the kill decision.
Yeah, as I recall, they're flying blowtorches that can actually disassemble a boat as it's moving.
Nothing to see here. Don't worry.
Yeah. Now, in fairness,
concerned?
It's a fantastic book. Daniel Suarez is his third book. His first was Damon, which is also a brilliant. Daniel and I have been in touch. I mean, I'm not going to say this was modeled after our community, but it certainly was informed by the knowledge of our community. I read the book. I was on a plane, actually. I was reading on my Kindle, and I was on a plane. And they were served the meal, and so I had closed my laptop, and I was reading the book about, you know, these irresponsible, you know, engineers would, you know, create these autonomous swarms of, you know, killer drones, and then they, you know, then they go run amok, and then they clear away the tray, and I close my Kindle, and I open up my laptop and start programming my swarming drone algorithms, and I'm like, oh, wait. That's how it happens. Should I stop? Should I close the laptop? And I'm like, no, because if I don't do it, someone else... I couldn't help myself. I was just like, this needs to be done. It needs to be created. Our swarms will be peaceful swarms. You know, no one would... You know, we will promote, you know, civil responsibility. But, you know, I don't know how to stop the march of technology. And, you know, by the way, all technologies can be used for ill. You know, computers can be, you know, used by hackers.
Yeah, of course.
And you can hit someone on the head with a hammer and... And well, here's what we do. So that sounds crazy responsible, and I probably should have shut the laptop, but I didn't. But here's what we do. We open source this technology, and we give it away on the internet to anybody. Now, first of all, you know, we're not the only ones doing this. There were lots of people doing it, and we feel that we're by doing it in a community that we have an opportunity to promote safe and responsible use. So we're really hardcore about not only telling people what's safe and responsible, not just don't weaponize, which is a good start, but also things about staying away from people and under 400 feet and visual line of sight and all this kind of stuff. The other is that we've reached out to all the regulators, all the relevant, you know, FBI and, you know, Pentagon, et cetera, and we've said, we've actually, you know, flown to Washington, briefed them on what's going on. We constantly invite them in. I get some of my quarterly briefings and a quarterly visit by the FBI, and we're like, you guys need to be in this community. We will open up to everything, and you need to know what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not my job to regulate. It's not my job to enforce. It's my job to help the regulators and enforcers do their job better. And so we feel that our responsibility is to bring those entities that we have trust in protecting our safety, bring them into the process and allow them to see what's possible, spot the bad guys early. By the way, we have a deal that if you say something in the community, if you just like, so here's my drone idea and, you know, and just going to go like a really long distance, and I thought it might be carrying a, you know, payload that might be a little dangerous, we're like, dude, that sounds totally sketchy, and we will call up our friends at the FBI just like that. And we've told them, everybody, that we're going to do it. And we feel that that's our responsibility, is to let the let the pros do their job.
Do you think it's time for Asimov's three laws of robotics?
So the three laws of robotics are basically sort of rules that would stop robots from killing. So the problem is that this makes, you know, everyone brings this up, and turns out that for a robot to be smart enough to apply the three laws, uh-huh, they've already taken over the world. Right? You know, it's really hard. That's artificial intelligence and sentience, mm-hmm, and cognition and all this kind of stuff. And it turns out that, you know, that like just shooting guns, that's easy. Robots are really good at bad stuff and really bad.
It's reassuring that people.
So, well, that's not the way it's going to happen. Is that we can't imbue our robots with the intelligence to make ethical choices. We need to we need to, as society and culture, mm-hmm. just watch what's going on, and evolve our regulatory and surveillance, abilities so that we can spot it early and stop it.
So let's get back to the synthetic biology, since we're talking about doomsday. So that's kind of the robotic doomsday scenario. We also had questions about, are we going to worry about hobbyists doing a killer virus? Do we need to worry about, you talked about the doctor emailing you, the DNA for vaccine. Your vaccine. What if someone sends you a spoofed email? We all know how easy email is to spoof. Hey, just ingest this and give it to your kids.
Yeah.
Worried about any of that stuff?
So I did talk to Craig Venter at length about this. Right now, DNA synthesis is done by big companies. And you can do this. You can design there's games on the internet. High school students do this. So lots of college students do this. You can design your own DNA sequence and send it to the synthesis labs, and they will fab it. They synthesize it, and you'll get back a little vial of the DNA you just invented. However, they're pretty good at spotting bad stuff. They're pretty good at spotting smallpox, for starters, and they have some general guidelines. You don't know exactly how they work, because they wouldn't tell you. That wouldn't be safe. But we trust them to protect us from that. Okay, that's when a few companies, are doing all the work. What if those things are on every desktop? So Craig Venter says, well, what we're going to do is we're going to ensure that there is, intelligence in the machines that goes and does a little lookup. Your sequence comes in. You want to print the sequence. It does a little lookup on the internet, and it needs to sort of, pass the test of not being dangerous. And only then will it print. And like right now, a photocopier. If you buy a photocopier, it actually has intelligence in it that'll look for U.S. currency, look for a U.S. dollar, and it won't. I've read this. I don't know whether it's actually true. I've never tried to photocopy a dollar bill, but they're supposed to be able to detect currency and either not let you do it or put some big watermark over it so it wouldn't work. So we do have some precedent to suggest that you can put technology in the machines that will check to make sure bad stuff doesn't happen. Is it fails foolproof? Probably not. Could it be hacked by somebody? Probably. But that's Craig's best answer to that question.
So you're sleeping fine over these issues.
I'm an optimist. B, I think that we can never anticipate these things ahead of time. Look, when I was a kid, when I was growing up, the notion of test tube babies was out there. Does anyone remember test tube babies? Right. When I was a kid, this was like the 70s, right? Uh-huh. It was like, I actually thought they were going to grow the babies in test tubes. And I thought they're going to be sort of long and skinny. And I was a little confused about this. Well, today, our babysitter's a test tube baby. We call it in vitro fertilization. It's no big deal. But at the time, it was super scary. We were, playing God, messing with nature, design. It was super scary. And then we did it, and we're like, oh, well, that's not so scary. And we kind of become comfortable with it. Right now, if I say clone, you're like, oh, no, well, that would be wrong. But, clone is kind of where test tube baby was 20, 25 years ago. So I think basically, as with any radical technology, we kind of have to try it out and, see how we feel and sort of, dip our toes into mm-hmm. it and probe a little bit and adapt how we feel about it based on social norms and demonstrated risks.
It's very cool to me to think that the three laws of robotics actually have to apply as ethical standards to the community. It's actually nothing to do with the robots at all, but it's actually an ethical challenge for us civilization.
Exactly. What do we know? We can't predict where technology is going. We can't stop technology because it's fully democratized. But all we can do is learn, try it on for size, see where it goes, and then adapt as both a society and as governments to real threats rather than imagined ones.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm feeling optimistic again. Now, I remember when I was learning about the history of the internet, I was a very early internet adopter. I grew up programming computers, and I remember being in the dot-com bubble and really feeling like I had basically missed the boat on the technology revolution. All the great companies had already been founded, and there was really nothing else to build or work on. And, of course, I was a complete idiot, didn't see the possibility of the social web. Everything that's happened in the last 10 or 12 years and the billions of dollars have been created, I felt like I already missed the boat. So we must have some people listening to this now who are feeling, well, the book's already been written and the movement's already underway. For that person who's thinking maybe they missed the boat, how do they catch up? How do they get started?
First of all, I hope no one's thinking that because we're looking at the biggest industries in the world, which have really not been, they've been touched by technology, but they haven't been touched by the social effects, mm-hmm. The social models of the web. What we have here, what the web taught us is that the missing markets were the markets of 10,000. you know, we knew how to reach markets of 10 million. That was Hollywood. We knew how to reach markets of 10. That was, you know, community and, you know, newsletters, et cetera. We didn't know how to reach 10,000. And then along comes the web, and it turns out that, you know, the long tail niche and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And some of those markets of 10,000 will become markets of 10 million. But we found a place for the specific, for the minority taste and for niches. Think of how many markets of 10,000 there are in the physical world. You know, right now we see it already in artisanal food. If you live in Brooklyn, you know all about markets of 10,000, right? You know, so you recognize that people want, as people get more discriminating in their tastes and more informed about their choices, they start to move out of mass markets and towards things that are just right for them, and they're often willing to pay more for it. Now, that's in artisanal stuff, which really is kind of handcrafty. Imagine if you take sort of all the appeal of the artisanal, but the technology of the industrial, mm-hmm. and then the distribution models of the Etsy's and the Kickstarters of the world, and now you have a way to take those market, to find those markets of 10,000, and they don't have to be 10,000 in one city. They can be a global distributed markets of 10,000. How many niches in the physical world are there that don't make sense for mass manufacturing, don't make sense for, you know, for your little workshop, but are now reachable with, you know, the industrialization of the maker movement?
Mm-hmm. On that note, I wanted to read something that you wrote towards the end of the book. He said, the maker movement tilts the balance toward the cultures with the best innovation model, not the cheapest labor. Societies that have embraced co-creation or community-based development win. They are unbeatable for finding and harnessing the best talent and more motivated people in any domain. Look for those countries with the most vibrant web communities flourish and with the most innovative web companies grow. Those are the values that predict success in any 21st century market. And a lot of the questions we got were about, you know, Silicon Valley and San Francisco became the center of the digital revolution. Where should we be looking for the center of the maker revolution? I'm sure we have a lot of people listening in from around the world who are thinking, if I want my city to be the Silicon Valley of the maker movement, what are the steps we should be taking to foster that kind of innovation and growth?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, the great thing about any distributed movement is that it doesn't have to be a center. You know, it's happening everywhere. The second thing is that one of the really cool surprises, I think, of the last 5 years is that Brooklyn or New York has turned out to be as much a center of the maker movement as San Francisco has. Why? I mean, how is it possible that we're bringing, you know, manufacturing to Brooklyn? You know, surely it's not about low-cost labor. And the answer is that as the tools get smaller and smarter and cheaper, it's less and less about big manufacturing and more and more about design, about the ideas, about the creativity, about the human component. And New York is the design center of America. It's got more design schools than anywhere else. And so New York's design skills compensate for its labor cost, you know, inefficiencies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fantastic that you can now move manufacturing to where the most creative, smartest people are. You don't have to have, you know, you don't have to move manufacturing to the lowest cost labor. You don't have to move manufacturing to, you know, brownfield sites in the middle of industrial wastelands. You can move manufacturing to where people live and where they have ideas and where they have needs. This is shorter supply chains, more sustainable manufacturing, just-in-time manufacturing, contact between the way things are made and the way they're consumed. This thing strikes me as being a fundamentally healthy model for...
Seems like a better ecological footprint.
Exactly,
too.
Yeah.
All right, we got time for one last question. And I know whenever you open questions up, this is the power of the internet and distributed anything, you always get at least one really wacky question. So I thought
so
I'd reserve that.
So you decided to end on that one.
So I thought we'd end on that if you don't mind. I like this one a lot. Okay. I'd love to see this scenario. Software tools on Earth used by people to design cool stuff and 3D printers on the moon, which produce that stuff using local material. How realistic is this, and what sort of stuff would you see produced up there?
Well, that is very explicitly the Star Trek replicator. That's where, you know, what you have is, I mean, in that model, and you guys remember, right, is that there's a box. And in the box has, like, presumably feedstocks of various sorts. I mean, I don't know whether they were atoms or molecules. Or
they never had to specify.
Yeah, it was just, imagine sort of lots of vials of goo that, you know, you would sort of say you want something, you know, tea, Earl Grey, hot, and it would just download the recipe. It would mix them in the right proportions. It would then fabricate them in the right layers, or, you know, sort of assemble the stuff, and then poof, you've got it. You know, this is a molecular assembly. This is, you know, atomic construction. I mean, it doesn't actually violate the laws of physics. I don't know how you do it exactly, but it actually almost could be done.
And how far away is that?
Well, the replicator, we're pretty far off from, you know, T. Earl Grey. Actually, that maybe I'm not sure. Maybe T wouldn't be that hard. But you know, so. So, you know, in that model, you're talking about about, you know, atomic assembly. Now, we do molecular assembly all the time. It's called your body, right? Every cell in your body knows how to do this already. We have a hard time, you know, creating synthetic machines that do it. But biology is a fantastic factory. It knows how to take, instructions, which is called DNA, assemble commodity proteins and molecules, which are just floating through your body, and create the most extraordinary machinery we've ever seen. Well, you in particular. So we know how to do it. And I think the answer is going to be less about machinery and more about harnessing the lessons of biology and creating biological factories that can assemble molecules for us.
Biology is a design challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, with that, we have to give our thanks to Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired and author of the new book, Makers, The New Industrial Revolution. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everybody that copies of Chris's new book, Makers, The Industrial Revolution, are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them in the lobby immediately following the program. We appreciate your allowing him to make his way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Eric Reese, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.